Hi, and welcome to The Full Perspective. I'm Charlie Thomas, Content Director for Insurance Insider, and each week I'm going to be talking to some of Insider Publishing's senior staff to dig into the week's most significant stories. This week I'm joined by Insurance Insider's Editor-in-Chief, Adam McNestry. Hi, Adam.
Hey, Charlie.
And Trading Risk's Managing Editor, Fiona Robertson. Hi, Fiona.
Hi.
Thanks for being with us, guys. So this week we're going to start with TR, which has done a deep dive into some of the points of tension between retro buyers and ILS providers regarding COVID-19. Fiona, what's at stake here?
Right. Well, there are two points of tension in the retro market at the moment. One is whether some of these retro contracts, many of them were written on the basis that they would cover natural perils, including but not limited to a certain list of natural disasters. Should the pandemic be considered something that is a natural peril in line with hurricane, wind, or earthquake? So that's the first question. And then the second is whether retro buyers should be able to trap their collateral and have it sticking around in case they need it in the future on the basis that the pandemic is an ongoing event for which they can't very easily determine their losses. Now, ILS providers say they should be able to use the standard trapping mechanism, which would involve them taking their reported loss that they've reported in Q1 or Q2 and factoring that up by a conservative margin to figure out whether they can do that. So that sounds like somewhat of a kind of arcane contract dispute, but actually it does have a really big impact because this is now the sort of third, fourth year where trapping has become a theme for the retro market. Investors are somewhat fed up with having that trapping issue and having a delay in getting their money back to them on top of, you know, the disappointing returns in the 17, 18 years when we had lots of natural catastrophe activity. And this is somewhat the kind of unknown loss, I suppose, or unexpected in that business interruption, COVID pandemic, it's not the kind of loss that investors expect to make their way through the retro market. So there are concerns about how could this trapping impact fundraising in the run up to 1/1 and the renewals. And as we already know, it was already becoming difficult and pricey to find your retro cover anyway.
Yeah, I think we shouldn't understate the importance of this. I think the retro market is going to have a really challenging run through to 1/1, particularly the ILS side of the aisle, which isn't as big as it was, but it's still probably over half of the retro market in terms of what's in force. I think there's some very big sums at dispute here, and I think there's a real challenge to the ILS business model. So I think there's going to be arguments over this. There's going to be disputes. There's going to be arbitration. There's potentially going to be court cases even. I think this really flags up the kind of the structural challenge around the product. So I think what we've learned about collateralized reinsurance since 2017 is that it probably works better in theory than it does in practice, because you get this situation where material information becomes available over time, but there's a lag, and therefore the cedents need to hold on to the collateral for a relatively long period of time in order that they can have certainty around their recoveries. But that creates a situation where unless new capital can be raised, the product just isn't there to be renewed. So you've got this kind of discontinuity and uncertainty around the availability of capacity from the ILS market, and that really does hamper the product. Now, we kind of got through 2017 into 2018 because it was possible to rapidly raise money, but since then there have been huge challenges for the ILS market. The collapse of CATCo, a succession of major loss years, concerns about the accuracy of the models that the money was raised off, and increased fears around climate change, and you're just not in a position where you can raise that money right now. So because of that structure, it's really hard to see the way in which the collateralized product can compete effectively with a rated balance sheet. And I think that's what the market is coming to realize right now, that that's probably not a fit for purpose product for a peril that's long tail. And that can be something like a pandemic, but actually just look at the Christchurch earthquake back in 2010. A number of companies have just reported deterioration on that. If you bought collateralized cover for that event, the money is long gone and you cannot recover.
I think that's quite a sweeping argument, and I do agree with bits and pieces of it. But I think that what I would pick out is that in general, even though we do have these challenging events like the New Zealand earthquake or the COVID pandemic, CAT is still essentially short tail, or what most people would consider short tail. And perhaps, you know, it ultimately does come down to buyers finding the right solution for what they need. And I don't think any ILS providers would disagree with that either. If you want capital to be around for a really long tail event, or whether there's really for something where there's really not a lot of certainty initially, like COVID, perhaps BI is the kind of thing that does need to be covered on a rated balance sheet. And I think you can see the ILS providers moving towards having that optionality to be able to offer that as well, because they recognize that. So I think the model is clearly evolving a lot. But that said, at the end of the day, you know, it did respond quite well, although it was painful for the investors, but it did respond quite well to Florida buyers, for example, in terms of Irma payouts. And I think that there will still be some investors, while there might be some disappointed investors, there will still be some investors on the ILS side who can see the uplift in rates coming in January, who I think will be sticking around and wanting to participate in that. So I wouldn't, you know, I think it's down but not out.
I think there's one other point to make here, which is that I think ultimately this is going to prove to be quite ironic, because I think there is going to be massive disruption for the ILS market in the run up to 1-1, because fundraising will be hard and capital will be trapped by conservative cedents. However, what they're doing is they're trapping that because they fear the tail event of COVID-19, i.e. there is an extreme scenario that would produce very severe losses for reinsurers and therefore for retro writers. But the likelihood of that is pretty low. And therefore, if the court cases do, as we would probably expect, resolve themselves relatively favorably, particularly in the States, then you have this situation where ILS was in turmoil ahead of 1-1, and the ultimate loss picture will be fine, but the ultimate loss picture won't be known for years and years. So I think it's pretty ironic the way it's going to ultimately be perceived.
Well, yeah, if those exclusions hold up, as reinsurers are arguing they should, then this isn't really an issue at all, is it?
Well, no, not ultimately in terms of losses, but in terms of operational disruption and the ability to deploy capital into the coming renewals, it's going to be huge for collateralized writers.
Okay, well, let's put a pin in that one there. I'm sure we'll end up coming back to that subject again and again. As you say, it's not a subject that's going away anytime now, between now and January. But I'm keen to move on to the next story today, which I know Adam's very keen to discuss as well, which is this new partner, Ikaveya partnership, which probably comes as a surprise to a number of our viewers at home following the somewhat messy failed takeover attempt in May. So for anyone who missed it this week, Adam, just give us an overview of what happened and your take on it.
Sure. So earlier this week, we had an announcement from Partner Re and Kaveya that a strategic partnership had been agreed that would see €750 million of Kaveya capital put to work by Partner Re through various vehicles. So they'd be underwriting on their behalf. €500 million goes in now ahead of 1-1, and then another €250 million goes in for 2022. And on the side, there's a €750 million deal with Exor, where Exor will manage some of Kaveya's assets. And it's a total shock. You know, these two were supposed to come together through a piece of M&A, a $9 billion M&A deal agreed in March, and the transaction collapsed in May, and it was a messy end. Kaveya tried to renegotiate the price on the deal, despite the fact that the initial takeover agreement explicitly noted the potential impact of COVID-19. But they bailed out, they paid the break fee, and I don't think anyone would have expected that the next thing that we would have heard about these two firms was that they were going to agree some kind of strategic alliance. yeah, it's been a winding road to get here, and I just think it's an unorthodox way to choose your trading partners, to say the least.
I think one thing that I'm interested to see is you know, what Partnery does with the investment support on the underwriting side from Covea, because Partnery is a company that I've followed a little bit from time to time. They do have some small sidecars, but they haven't really built out a kind of brand name flagship ILS platform like other people, reinsurers who run sidecars. They will have been struggling with the retraction of support from major sidecar investors like Stoneridge or Credit Suisse or others. So the fact that they've been able to get this $750 million in the door is actually quite probably a bit of a shot in the door for their, you know, quota share sidecar partnership capital that they have on tap.
I mean, rightly, I think the spotlight, you know, we've sort of focused on the Partnery XOR element of it. But I'm wondering what it actually means for Covea going forward as well, because, you know, they've had an interesting few months.
Well, I think they've had an interesting couple of years. You know, they had that very tumultuous takeover bid with SCOR, you know, real tussle between Thierry Durez from Covea and Denny Kessler at SCOR. You know, very, very public fights in the trade press, in the French business press, hugely acrimonious, and it spawned a series of lawsuits, including criminal proceedings against Durez, who was on the SCOR board when he was sort of plotting the takeover. And you've had that. They've had, you know, they made as they were working on their takeover of Partnery, there were also various sort of challenges to them around the regulatory environment in France, where they came under pressure because Durez had too much influence and too much power. And they've now been asked to split the chairman and CEO roles, as SCOR has. So I think this is something that brings to an end, not in the way we probably expected, a long struggle from Covea to secure access to the reinsurance market for diversification by line of business and by geography, because it gives them global exposures. I suppose it's a more modest exposure to the reinsurance market than we were expecting. They tried to buy SCOR, they tried to buy Partnery. Had they done those transactions, they would have been something like a third reinsurance. As it is, they're going to have exposure via 500 million and 750 million euros of kind of deployed capital. So this is a smaller foray into reinsurance for Covea. I think also noteworthy is we probably, and I say probably because it's not certain, but probably we've lost the only cash buyer for a major reinsurance franchise from the marketplace. You know, they tried with SCOR, then they tried with Partner, it seems like they're probably not going to try with someone else, given these are multi-year arrangements and they won't want to compete against themselves. So anybody who thought they might attempt to buy SCOR again, or buy, say, AXA XL Re, or I don't know, try and prize Transre away from Allegheny, that's probably not going to happen now. So it's kind of, it's probably a negative for anybody who wanted to sell a major reinsurance franchise.
Okay, we're going to have to wrap it up there today, unfortunately. So my thanks to Fiona and to Adam for joining me. Thanks, guys.
Thanks, Charlie.
And thank you guys for watching at home. Until next time, stay well, keep safe, and we hope you'll join us again for another episode of The Full Perspective.